Telemetry News Now.
Welcome to another episode of Telemetry News Now. I'm Phil Gervasi, joined, as always, by Justin Ryburn. And we are recording a couple days out from, for me at least, a long weekend for the Easter holiday. Justin, are you doing anything this weekend? Are you going anywhere special?
Actually, my daughter has First Communion tomorrow night on Monday, Thursday, as part of a Holy Week celebration in our household. So looking forward to that. Yep. Big day in our household. She's growing up, you know.
Growing up. I have a daughter, my oldest daughter. I have three kids, but my oldest daughter is 18, graduating high school this year. And growing up is very top of mind for me. You know, on one hand, I'm really glad because I can see, you know, some amazing improvements in her life and changes. And that's exciting. But on the other hand, I'm like, please stay little. I don't want you to grow up. But my brother is turning 40 on Sunday, so we'll be celebrating both Easter and my brother's 40th birthday at my mom's house.
There you go. Nice.
So that'll be a lot of fun. So we are recording on April 16th, midweek, and we do have some exciting, what I think are some exciting headlines to dive into, so let's get started. From OpenAI's website on April 14th, you didn't think we were going to get through an episode without talking about OpenAI, did you? Well, OpenAI releases GPT-4.1 in the API. OpenAI just introduced the GPT-4.1 model family. So that includes models like GPT-4.1, 4.1 Mini, and 4.1 Nano. And these reportedly have significant performance improvements over previous models like GPT-4.0, GPT-4.5, specifically encoding, instruction following, and long context understanding. That's really interesting, because they added the ability to process up to 1 million tokens. And I personally think that's a big deal, because there have been and are other foundational models out there that have already been operating at that level with very large context windows, whether it was a million tokens or not. And there are potential issues with filling up an entire context window and then expecting, you know, a completely accurate result. But nevertheless, the ability to handle that is now there in this model family. So according to OpenAI, these models not only offer higher accuracy on industry standard benchmarks, you can go look that up, but also to enable powerful, what they say, powerful real-world applications in software engineering, legal document analysis, being able to enable agent-based automation, right? That's the hot ticket right now, so of course. And I personally think it's clear that OpenAI is trying to focus more on you know, real-world utility, not being that kind of generic, I say generic in air quotes, that general foundational model. They're taking developer feedback seriously. A lot of developers I know will use other competitive models. And of course, you got to love the naming convention, right, Justin?
Yeah.
If you're using the latest model, right, which is 4.5, you will now be upgrading to 4.1. And that makes total sense.
And upgrading that from GPT-4.0,
I know.
Which wasn't O as in zero, O as in the letter
exactly,
O.
Exactly, for Omni. They're tough with their naming conventions. A couple of things to wrap up here with this one. The 4.1 family of models are available via API only. So you're not going to log into ChatGPT and be able to select that. But, you know, for those of us already running some sort of chatbot, you can swap in 4.1 to replace whatever you're using now. So that's available. And you're going to see some improvements. And we're also going to see 4.5 slowly deprecated as well, which is very interesting. Because a lot of the models, they don't get deprecated right away. You know, like you could still use 4 and, you know, assuming 4 Omni is going to be around for a while. So it is interesting that they're going to deprecate that right away. Not exactly sure why. I saw a couple of things on like some YouTube channels I follow where folks had some commentary there, but I don't know if it's true or not.
Yeah. It's interesting how much they focused on it, the application that it has to coding and software engineering, right?
Yeah.
They have an entire benchmark test on their website that shows how it compares to some of their previous models when it comes to coding exercises. So there definitely seems to be a big focus on that as the use case for this, which I found kind of interesting, especially considering it's available by the API. So presumably if you have, I don't know, VS Code or something that you're using as a front end, you could configure the API to be able to talk to GPT 4.1. I haven't tried that, Phil. I don't know if you have, but I presume that's the use case for this.
I agree. The graphs there, which were very minimalistic. I love OpenAI's like graphics department. They're like very, very simple. So it's like, yeah, you can kind of, you know, read into it what you will. But, you know, they highlighted things like latency and accuracy, but also cost. So if you are doing a lot of work, you know, production work with these models, which a lot of folks are doing now at an enterprise level, you know, cost does become an option. So yeah, I agree and see clearly that OpenAI is trying to accommodate this developer life cycle, developer world and activity. And I don't know if 4.1 or any models within that family will become available, like in the ChatGPT interface. If so, you know, that would be interesting to see and to totally experiment with it there as well.
Yeah. The other thing I'll highlight on this, and then we can move on, is they actually released a prompting guide with this one as well to try and help people do good prompts around coding to get the best results back from the model. So that's kind of interesting. So,
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So moving on from the Cisco newsroom, on April 9th, Cisco and Google Cloud have deepened their partnership by integrating Cisco's SD-WAN with Google's fully managed Cloud WAN. You may have seen this one already. So the idea here is that this is going to enable enterprises, large organizations to securely and efficiently connect on-prem data centers with cloud workloads using Google's global backbone. So of course, you know, since you're on their backbone, you're going to see faster performance, hopefully simplified management, right? And then more consistent security across your, in this case, hybrid environments we're talking about most likely. And from the Cisco side, you're going to be able to use Cisco's cloud on-ramp and then, of course, vManage orchestration for your SD-WAN. Now, according to Cisco, the move is going to address growing complexity in enterprise WANs caused by cloud adoption and fragmented security models. And Justin, that's something that we talk about at Kentik, right? The whole idea of lack of observability, visibility, and then inherent management over hybrid environments when you own certain parts of the infrastructure, and then you have providers in the mix and cloud providers as well. So yeah, it's a new partnership, clearly about unifying this hybrid network and, you know, addressing the security issues when you have a hybrid environment. But before we move on to, you know, any kind of commentary from the Juniper newsroom, also on April 9, I just wanted to throw this in now and we can kind of discuss both at the same time.
Was there something going on last week, Phil, that there's two announcements on the same day from competing vendors about a partnership with Google?
Yes, there was a Google event, which I believe you attended, right?
No, I wasn't able to make it this year. I usually do, but unfortunately I wasn't able to make it this year, but we did have a team there. So I heard good things about it.
Yeah. So from their newsroom on April 9, we read that Juniper Networks has expanded its collaboration with Google Cloud to integrate its AI-native Mist networking platform with Google's Cloud WAN. Now, this is not exactly the same as what Cisco's doing with Google, but we'll keep going here. So I think this is interesting and not at all unexpected, of course, right? So according to Juniper, this would enable rapid deployment of secure high-performance campus and branch networks directly from the Google Cloud Marketplace. And yes, we are talking about utilizing Google's backbone as well. So the integration is meant to simplify enterprise networking because now you can, you know, access Juniper's wired, wireless, NAC firewall, SD-WAN services as cloud-delivered solutions. And, you know, like we just discussed briefly with Cisco, reduce reliance on on-prem hardware, address some of those security inconsistencies and that sort of thing. You know, for me, though, the language of Juniper's announcement had a lot more AI in it compared to Cisco. They explain, they being Juniper, that this move underscores the growing importance of AI ops in delivering reliable connectivity for Gen AI workloads and, you know, distributed enterprise applications. To what extent this actually addresses complexity and performance demands, right, of modern distributed IT environments, I really don't know, because I'm not so sure that every enterprise out there is going to be deploying those kinds of at-scale AI solutions that a lot of network vendors are expecting. You know, we've always had the build versus buy argument in software in general, right?
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of the time, yeah, you're going to build your own thing. And I think, though, in the realm of AI ops and at the enterprise level, at doing it at scale, we're going to see a lot more people tend toward buy than build because the complexity of AI ML pipelines and the level of effort required and the resources, you know, just the data engineering part are very, very difficult. I don't necessarily expect to see every enterprise out there having these distributed inferencing activities going on. I think they're going to be purchasing. And maybe there is something to say there if, you know, the solution that you're using is looking at data in one cloud and then, you know, inferencing is done in another cloud. And so, you know, maybe there is something there.
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell from Juniper's article from their newsroom, but I want to say that AI ops language is coming from the fact that it's integrating with Mist, right? Which is the basis of their, call it their SD-WAN, right? They AI built into Mist and have for a long time to do a lot of things in their wireless networks, like finding a radio that's having an issue and migrating all the customers. But they have a lot of automation that's based on AI that has been built into the Mist product for a long time, which is why Juniper bought that and why it has such a great reputation in the industry. And Juniper's been rolling that out more across their enterprise switching line and their campus and branch, which is the BU that did this announcement, by the way, is their campus and branch BU. So presumably that's the WAN solution that they're integrating with Google's Cloud WAN. So that's why there's so much AI language in there. It's not so much that the AI workloads are running over the top of the network that they're built as much as they're leveraging AI to help make the routing and how the traffic is flowing on the joint network that they're building here more performant.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that leads into the next headline, this idea that AI is more than an LLM wrapper, right? That there is some other type of activity that's been going on for literally decades under the banner of AI that we don't seem to talk about anymore, but is still critical. So I'm going to move right on to it, and you'll see what I mean. From Broadcom, right? From the Broadcom product news room, news release, whatever they call it, dated April 15th. So this is their website. Broadcom has just introduced Incident Prediction, an AI-powered security feature for Semantic Endpoint Security Complete. That's SESC for those of you that, you know, like acronyms or initialisms, whatever that is. And it's designed to predict and disrupt cyber attacks, especially an attack technique called living off the land. Which, if you're not familiar with living off the land, is when you have some sort of an attack vector where the bad guy comes in and then utilizes whatever installed resources exist already, you know, WMI or, you know, whatever applications you have already, and utilizes those as their method of attack. So this feature, Incident Prediction, was trained on over 500,000 real-world attack chains, and it's supposed to be able to proactively forecast attacker behavior. And that's also very important. What's also very important is that it can automatically then mitigate the threat without interrupting business operations, or as Broadcom puts it, overburdening SOC analysts. I like this approach because it's this idea of intelligent real-time defense. It, you know, reduces the need for blunt responses like quarantining devices, locking out users, and all that kind of thing. But I also think, like I was alluding to just a moment ago, that this is a compelling example of how AI is moving from, you know, detection to full-on tactical defense, and that it's not an announcement of a chatbot or the latest LLM wrapper, or, you know, around some other feature, which, by the way, I think those are awesome and very cool and great. That's fine. But this is acknowledging the whole world of predictive analytics that has so much, just tremendous value in what we do in IT operations. And in this case, in security operations. So I think this is a really interesting announcement from Broadcom. You know, from a technical perspective, at least for me, it's very fascinating.
Yeah, I had never heard of living off the land attack, so this was really interesting to learn something new about that type of an attack. And yeah, I think both you and I, Phil, have sat through industry talks where people talked about how many attack vectors AI brings, because it makes bad actors, the people that we're trying to stop more powerful, because they can use AI to be more advanced than their attacks, whether it's using audio recordings to make it sound like it's someone's voice on the other end, doing social engineering type of attacks, phishing attacks, or, you know, other type of attack vector. So most of the focus of talks that I've seen is on how AI can be used as an attack vector. It's good to see finally some news coming out about how we can actually use it to stop different types of attacks, and being able to use the predictions that AI can bring and what the next word's going to be able to see that this is an attack vector and not legitimate user behavior. So
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think it's new. You know, I mean, there have been, especially in the security world, there have been folks using some of these techniques like traditional clustering algorithms and regression, you know, time series family models kind of things, where they can identify events that go together that are indicative of an attack. They can compare activity to like a current threat feed or a CV, things like that. So that kind of activity has been going on for a while, sometimes homegrown, sometimes it's just part of your SIM and not really utilized. And the desire there is to reduce the number of false positives, because that, like, level one SOC analysts are chasing every little thing that they see. And then, you know, 80%, 90% are nothing to chase. So how do you reduce that? If you can add intelligence where you can really accurately identify what's something that's real, what's something that's not real, or what's something that needs to be addressed, that's a concern. That's really cool. And I'm glad to see that. You know, that's an interesting thing. I've been really, really interested in the realm of ML and AI for some years. And then, of course, I jumped on this bandwagon with LLMs the past 2 years as well, because it was the latest manifestation of that. And so that's cool. But I wonder if this excitement around large language models the past couple of years, and now getting into agents and things like that, is actually giving, like, reawakening our industry, IT, but everyone in general, reawakening folks to the value of, like, traditional AI operations, like predictive analytics, forecasting, you know, identifying correlations and patterns and things like that. Stuff that, again, we've been doing for years and years and years. And it's, you know, stuff that you can, you know, if you have the data, you can start building an ML ops, you know, pipeline right now and start looking at data in your own infrastructure. And so, you know, it kind of went under the radar for a long time. And now folks are like, oh, we can do this? Well, we've always been able to, but this like recent buzz around large language models helped reawaken that. I don't know. That's just something thinking about.
Talked to a lot of people who were really excited about networking for the first time. Networking has gotten boring. I think you brought this up on one of the Telemetry Now podcast recently that, you know, you can only talk about BGP or the latest routing protocol or some new TLV that's been added into the new routing protocol so many times before. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of tired talking about this, right? So I think if nothing else, AI is bringing some new exciting things to networking that's interesting to talk about for the first time in quite a while. So I think that's why a lot of people are excited. It's like, I was talking to somebody at the AutoCon conference last fall, and they were saying that like they feel like a kid again, right? Like they can wake up every morning excited to like play with this new latest model and try and apply it in this new different way. There's just a lot of new, cool, fun things to learn. And I think that's why, you know, there's a lot of excitement around this. And the other thing that came to mind as you were talking about how long this has been around for specifically for security is one of the challenges that security practitioners have is they want to be a little bit careful in how much they share about how they're blocking attacks and how they're protecting themselves. Because the more that the bad actors find out about how they're protecting themselves, the more they can turn that against them, right? And so we as, you know, networking professionals tend to think in community and sharing best practices and sharing everything we possibly know with each other. But, you know, security practitioners have to be a little bit more careful than that because it could be turned against them. So you're right. There probably has been a lot more AI used in defense and security defense for a long time. It just doesn't get talked about much because people don't share their best, can't share their best practices.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, one thing to think of or to consider here is that everything we've been talking about within the realm of IT and in this case, security operations is operations focused. It really is. You know, it's not like in marketing where you're trying to predict churn rate or what visual ad will people most likely click on or troop movement, you know, of nation state military kind of things. We're talking about how do I improve operations, reduce the amount of time it is to wade through all these new events and tickets that come in, you know, into my SOC, or how do I predict which SFPs are going to fail in my data center more easily rather than just, you know, wait for them to fail. So there's, it's all operationally focused. And that's interesting because it's all meant to improve like the life of a network engineer. And that makes a lot of sense. That's why I see so much value. And, you know, in my opinion, that's one of the reasons I'm so interested in this field in the past few years, for sure.
Yep. All right, moving on to the next article from PC Magazine titled Amazon Wants to Build Tens of Millions of, I believe they're pronounced Kuiper. It's K-U-I-P-E-R. I'm going to presume it's pronounced
Kuiper. I think that's Kuiper, like the Kuiper Belt.
Kuiper. Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, Kuiper dishes to compete with Starlink. So all of the media and all of the hype recently has been around Starlink, and they are doing a fantastic job, no doubt. We've talked about it a number of times on the podcast, some of the underserved markets that they're going into to help them get high-speed internet that have never been able to a lot of times because of the terrain. But there are other companies in that game. I know you had a recent podcast talking about satellite internet and low Earth and medium Earth orbit, and there are various different operators that are out there actually beyond just Starlink. And of course, Amazon's got their own thing, this Kuiper that we're talking about, where they want to send up tens of millions of satellites to build a full mesh similar to what SpaceX has to be able to compete with Starlink internet. So, you know, so far they're playing a little bit of catch up. They're behind Starlink as far as the number of satellites that they have in the sky, but they're working hard on manufacturing these new satellites, and then they're obviously going to have to do some launches to get these into the sky so that they can provide this service. So,
yeah.
Jeff Bezos, who's still obviously affiliated with Amazon, has his Blue Origin space company. So presumably they'll be the one, doesn't really talk about it in the article, but presumably they'll be the ones that'll be helping Amazon put these Project Kuiper satellites up into the sky.
Yeah, there's some hurdles here. There's tight timelines. There's logistical hurdles. I mean, they're building everything in-house. So there's that. Maybe that's not a hurdle. Maybe that's a good thing. But according to the FCC, there's a mandate that they have to launch half of their 3,200 satellites by mid next year, mid 2026. So there's a scale, there's a timeline urgency behind this investment. And I mean, that also signals that Amazon is very serious about being a contender in the satellite internet market. Is that what it's called? I don't know. But I agree with you. Catching up with Starlink is not going to be easy. I mean, we're talking about anticipating launches of the first production satellites.
Well, and like even Amazon was prepared to launch its first production satellite in orbit this past Wednesday, and it had to get, or maybe it was today. It's not clear from the article which Wednesday they're talking about, but they had to scrub that launch due to the weather, right? So that's the kind of challenges and logistics that you deal with when you're trying to build an internet-based, I'm sorry, space-based internet company like Starlink or Kuiper, is you got to continually deal with changes in the weather and being able to do your launches, not being able to do your launches, rockets that launches that don't go the way you expect and so forth. So it's not easy to get these things up in the sky. And then even once you get them in the sky, your recent podcast I found really fascinating, where you're talking about all the challenges and keeping them in the right line so they can communicate with each other, not running into each other, not running into other space debris that's up there. There's all kinds of challenges that we who are normal terrestrial network engineers mm-hmm. that have cables in the ground don't really think mm-hmm. about.
Yeah, speaking of the ground, there's also the initiative to build the ground-based stations, mm-hmm. the gateway stations, right? Which, you know, you sort of need, you know, for the satellites to communicate with to get the signal back and then propagate it out here on Earth. So there's a lot of activity there. And you mentioned, you know, rocket failure. We're not talking about like Starlink using SpaceX rocket systems. It's a different animal that Amazon is dealing with. So yeah, catching up with Starlink is not going to be easy. That's for sure.
All right, moving right along, we actually have three articles related to NVIDIA that we'll talk about here. The first one is actually from NVIDIA's blog site itself, talking about how they're going to be moving some of their manufacturing of their AI chips, of their silicon, back to the U.S. for the first time. So I think we've talked about it previously on the podcast, but NVIDIA doesn't actually manufacture their own chips. They don't actually own the factories that manufacture their chips. They design them. And then they outsource the actual manufacturing of them to a number of different vendors, which their business model is they build manufacturing plants and do all the tooling to be able to build all the chips. And the primary company that they use for their Blackwell chip, which is what they're planning on bringing back to the U.S., is a company called TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor. Mm-hmm. Taiwan Semiconductor is building a plant in Phoenix, Arizona, with plans to build some additional ones in Texas. Once those facilities are built, then they'll be able to manufacture some of these AI chips back in the U.S. They also have partnerships, which I wasn't aware of until reading this article, with a company named Foxconn, which is a company we used to manufacture some of our silicon when I was at Juniper as well. But they're building facilities in Houston and in Dallas. So obviously, NVIDIA's investing heavily in trying to come up with other places to manufacture their chips beyond China, due to the recent tariffs, which, you know, is what the tariffs are intended to do, is cause companies to try and shift more of their manufacturing to places where the U.S. has a little more friendly trade agreements. So,
yeah, I mean, the CEO of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang, commented, adding American manufacturing helps us better meet the incredible and growing demand for AI chips and supercomputers, strengthens our supply chain and boosts our resiliency. So, you know, that's a very corporate answer, right?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that's kind of teased out in there a little bit is, even if it weren't for the tariffs and even if they weren't having to shift around where things are being manufactured to lower their costs, when tariffs included, we know there's a lot of demand for AI chips, right? So they're having to scale up and manufacture more chips in more places just to deal with the demand, right? So question would be, even if the tariffs weren't in place, how much of this would they be doing? Might not necessarily be on U.S. soil, but I bet they'd still be working with TSMC and Foxconn, some of these other vendors, mm-hmm. to be able to scale up, just because they got to be able to meet the demand, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So the next article is actually from Reuters, talking about how NVIDIA is actually facing a $5.5 billion charge as U.S. restricts sales to China. And so I also found a Yahoo Finance article talking about the same thing. Essentially, the U.S. has banned the export of the H20 chips that NVIDIA manufactures. So it's just specifically that chip, but that is one of its most popular chips that Chinese companies were importing into China. NVIDIA was exporting from the U.S. And so they've been barred from exporting those out of the United States. Once this news broke on this overnight, NVIDIA's stock fell 5% in pre-market trading on today, Wednesday, April 16th. Mm-hmm. So that's where the $5.5 billion number is coming from. That's what they expect the impact to their revenue to be from those chips having been banned from being exported from the U.S. to China. So, you know, they're obviously going back to the previous article. They're going to need to staff up or to scale up the U.S. and other places where they can manufacture these chips pretty quickly.
Yeah. And those chips were interestingly designed initially to comply with other US regulations that we've had in place and was commonly used, especially, you know, by Chinese AI companies, you know, Tencent, Alibaba, ByteDance. Well, Alibaba's not Chinese, is it? Actually, yes, it is.
It is.
Yeah. Yep. But anyway, used for AI inference workloads. So it's not necessarily like NVIDIA's highest end chip, but certainly that's where the concern is, that like, wait a minute, this does fall in the line of like supercomputers and therefore triggering the export ban. So yeah, this is, you know, the ongoing efforts of the US to limit China's access to this kind of advanced technology, specifically computer technology related to AI, I guess in the name of national security and the name of trade deficits, right?
Yeah. It's hard to keep up with all this. I mean, you know, as we know, there's, I think it's 125% now reciprocal tariffs that the U.S. has put on any imports from China. And then China's done the same for any imports from the U.S. to China. And then I think it was either late last week or early this week, President Trump announced they were going to pause that for silicon and chips and so forth, which really helped Apple and NVIDIA companies who actually manufacture their chips in China and import them into the U.S. But then shortly after that, it was announced that there will be new tariffs specifically to that coming. So we're waiting to kind of hear what that's going to look like. So there, I feel for the CEOs at some of these tech companies, it's an evolving situation every day. It seems like there's a new announcement they've got to figure out how to deal with and
how does this relate to like existing deployments, you know, like that Tencent and DeepSeek already have? Does it affect that at all?
Well, presumably, if they already have deployments, they already have the chips running in their network. It doesn't impact that as much, but, you know, they're going to have to scale up, right? They're going to have to continue to add new chips and new servers as they scale up and build bigger and bigger models or have more demand for the existing models. So, you know, it really only impacts them if they're buying new chips, new servers, but it doesn't really, as far as I know, from everything I've read, doesn't really impact existing infrastructure that you've already acquired.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how the geopolitical tensions of our day are literally one of the main drivers. Maybe it's always been like this and I'm just naive, but they're literally reshaping the AI landscape. In this case, from a hardware perspective, you know, if we're talking about export policy being now a major driver of market dynamics when it comes to this and corporate strategy, right? And presumably even development. And so it's very,
I mean, I think it always has been on some level. It just didn't move as fast as it seems like it has since, you know, the Trump administration took over, right? It just seems like it's moving at a speed and a scale that we've never seen before. It's like changing on a daily basis, whereas normally policy takes a while, right? It gets discussed in one house of, either the House or the Senate, and then it goes through, it gets approved, it gets signed by the president. Like, that doesn't move that quickly. And so if you're, you know, a CEO that's company's going to be affected by new legislation that's going through the normal process, you've got some time to work with your team and your board and figure out how that's going to impact you and what you're going to do about it. These have been moving so quickly through the process and changing so quickly. Mm-hmm. It's got to be really difficult for companies like NVIDIA and Apple to deal with the constant changes, but they definitely seem to be doing the best they can with it. So,
and that's the price of doing business. You know, it's what it is. So let's move on to upcoming events. On April 17th, which is probably the day you're listening to this particular episode, is the Massachusetts Networking User Group, part of the USNUA, and that's in Framingham, Massachusetts, just outside Boston. And I will be on the panel for that one, so I'll be driving out there, which is a lovely drive across Massachusetts from upstate New York where I am. So I'm looking forward to that tomorrow and seeing some friends. We have AI Infrastructure Field Day, part of the Field Day organization, Tech Field Day, and that is on April 23rd through 25th, live streamed, and of course you can see them on their website, YouTube channel, and in the subsequent blog posts and commentary. The Virginia Networking User Group, also part of the USNUA, is April 24th. And Justin and I will both be attending that. That's the one that's led by our good friend, Scott Roban, friend of Kentick, friend of the show, and a friend of Justin and mine as well. So we appreciate that and look forward to seeing each other there. On May 5 through 7, Justin will be attending Knowledge 2025, which is ServiceNow's user conference. Justin, can you give me a little color about that one? Because I don't know too much about that event.
Yeah, this is, you kind of think it is like the Google Cloud Next that Google had last week. It's similar for ServiceNow and for ServiceNow's product. It's their annual user conference. They'll have all their vendors there talking about the various integrations that they're users might benefit from, and that's why I'll be attending. Kentick has an integration with ServiceNow, so we'll be there talking to some of our joint customers about what the work we're doing with ServiceNow to improve our integration with them. So looking forward to that one.
All right. Next, we have the Colorado Networking User Group on May 8th. Justin's going to be on the panel for that one. And then there's the Chicago NOG, CHINOG. That's not the USNUA. That's the different organization. That's on May 15th. Justin will be attending that one. And we're going to stop it with a month out, May 15th. Certainly, there are some exciting events coming up in the end of May that I can't wait to talk about, but we're going to hold off on it for now. So until next time, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.